Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Joseph Pache. Our topic tonight is student data privacy. According to a recent study by Fordham Law School, 95% of school districts around the country are using cloud-based programs to manage information about students, including grades, test scores, and classroom behavior. Yet researchers found that only about a fifth of school districts have any uniform policies to govern the use of online programs. And only a small percentage inform parents that student information is being uploaded and stored in the cloud. The lack of standards and transparency about cloud-based school information programs is energizing parents to take action. Just last week, InBloom, a national data collection effort that raised over $8 million from the Gates Foundation, announced it was closing in the wake of parent concerns about data security and privacy. Here in the Bay Area, schools and teachers are bombarded with marketing for new apps and programs that offer easy solutions for managing student information. Yet many of these programs have limited safeguards for ensuring the privacy or security of this data. As more education startups enter this lucrative market, there's a growing movement to create common standards to protect student privacy and ensure that companies do not sell or reuse information about children. Just last week, the White House released a white paper that advocated for increased security and privacy measures for student data. So tonight, we talk about concerns regarding the growth of the cloud-based programs in schools. Are companies doing enough to keep student information safe and secure? What questions do parents need to ask their teachers, schools, and districts about the use of programs that manage and share their children's data? Joining us tonight are three people who are working closely on this issue of data privacy and security in schools. Here in the studio, we're joined by Ann Duncan. She is the Chief Technology Officer for the Palo Alto Unified School District, managing all aspects of the district's technology infrastructure and professional development. Prior to joining Palo Alto USD, Ann worked for Hewlett-Packard for 20 years in a variety of engineering and senior management positions. And she was recently nominated by President Obama for a position at the Environmental Protection Agency in Washington. Welcome, Ann.
Thank you.
We're also joined here in the studio by Tony Porterfield. He is the father of two elementary-aged children in Los Altos and an engineer who has worked for over 20 years in the computer and networking industries in Silicon Valley. Tony has been a vocal advocate for strengthening student privacy safeguards, and his effort to improve school information security was covered by the New York Times in June 2013. Welcome, Tony.
Thank you.
And by phone, we're joined by Krista Sumanik. She is the Director of Communications at Common Sense Media, a national nonprofit organization based here in San Francisco that provides parents with information and advice about media and technology. An award-winning TV news veteran, Krista helps communicate about Common Sense Media's efforts to engage lawmakers, policy advocates, educators, and industry leaders in protecting kids' privacy as they use technology. Welcome, Krista.
Hi, Joseph.
And we'd like to note that we did reach out to several education technology companies to appear on tonight's program, but we were unable to book them for tonight's show. We do have a statement that we'll be reading later in the program from one of those companies. So thanks again to all of you for joining me here in the studio and on the phone. And, of course, to our listeners, we'd like to hear your comments and questions about this topic. You can email us now at cityvisions@kalw.org or post a question on the KLW website. And in about 20 minutes or so, we'll open our phone lines at 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134 for your questions and comments. So, Krista Sumanik, I wanted to start with you. Why don't you give us a quick thumbnail sketch of the landscape of educational technology that is now being used in the classroom. Give us a sense of what educators are using and what kinds of things they're doing with that technology.
Sure, Joseph. Well, we recognize that technology, at Common Sense Media, we say that, you know, used wisely, it has immense potential to transform learning for kids, all kids, wherever they are in this country. It's a powerful tool that, you know, can be applied, doesn't matter where children are, economic opportunities, neighborhoods. Anyway, getting to it, the way that the technology is used in the classrooms is really cloud computing. There's, you know, all of the Google apps for education, as you know. There's different platforms there. There's network infrastructure. There's different apps and games and websites that they actually use, the content side as well. So, you know, these platforms really have opportunities to help kids communicate, create, and learn like never before. and make learning really relevant to them. And teachers are really excited by the opportunity. It's now just making sure that we put some security around how these platforms and these programs are used so that kids can really have a safe learning environment when they're at school.
And Duncan, I wanted to ask you, what do you know of the apps or programs that are being used in the Palo Alto Unified School District?
So there are lots and lots of education technology apps available to teachers. And these days, one of the challenges we have is that they're marketed directly to those teachers. They come right into the classroom and bypass us. And so we have a huge educational battle with our teachers to make sure they understand what they can use and how to appropriately get permission to use those applications. They are, as Krista said, incredibly useful and valuable for students if used properly, but very challenging otherwise.
Can we drill down a little bit and tell me some examples of what teachers are using?
So teachers are using everything from educational games in the classroom to learn basic skills to learning management solutions where we can package and run an entire class so the teacher has an online platform where they can have discussion groups and assignments and the students can help share with each other. We also have infrastructure-type tools like our student information system, which is also a very important component of the school district and of security for student data.
Okay. So it sounds like there's technology that is really part and parcel of the pedagogy, so to speak, and then there's the management of all the data that you need to be able to run a school or a school district.
That's correct. And there are literally hundreds, if not thousands, of applications that teachers use in our school district, and we have to sort out which ones are completely harmless from those that collect really personal student data that we need to really carefully analyze.
And Tony Porterfield, when did you become aware that your kids' schools were using some of the programs that we're talking about, some of the apps, and how'd you find out about it, and what'd you learn?
Yeah, it actually started not at school, but with coaching a youth sports team. And the league was promoting the use of one of the team, sort of team coordination sites. And I was, as the coach, I was being kind of prompted to set up one of these sites. And in the course of filling it out, I noticed how much information they were collecting and that they weren't using SSL at the time.
Tell us a little
sorry,
more about
SSL, that. Sorry, the Secure Sockets Layer, which provides a couple things. The thing people most talk about is the encryption, which prevents snooping, but it also provides an element of trust that the person you're speaking to or communicating with on the other end of the connection is who they say they are, and then it hasn't been tampered with in between.
And back to you for a second. Why are these technologies so appealing to teachers? What is it giving them? What edge is it giving them in the classroom that they wouldn't have otherwise? I'm trying to understand why this would be so appealing.
So I think there's a couple things. One is it's going to help these students learn 21st century skills that they need to be successful citizens. So going out to be ready for career and college means you need to understand how to use technology. So that's the basic things that we use now, like word processing and email. But you'll see in the workplace in the future, being able to develop a web page, being able to create a visually stunning presentation, all sorts of things that many of us never had to do in our careers, or at least until recently, these kids need to be able to do for college and career. So being able to be technology literate is one piece of it. But also, it allows the teachers to create much more exciting, engaging lessons that students can really find fun and interesting. And it gives them lots of opportunities for kids to also be self-directed, work in small groups, and work at their own pace.
So this is really about helping kids to really plug in to learning the skills that you say that they're going to need for the rest of their lives. So it's really essential on some level.
Yeah, we can't sort of close the door and say we're not going to use technology in our schools and in our classrooms. This is the world that students live in. We can't say, come to school, which we do in many schools, come to school, turn off all your devices, and grab a pencil and paper. We need to work in the 21st century. Mm-hmm. We need to work with the technology, and we need to find ways to help students learn how to be good digital citizens and protect their identity and safety.
There's also the component, too, I've got to mention, Joseph, of personalizing learning, which is really appealing to parents, students, and teachers alike.
Right. So back to you, Tony. You started to dig a little deeper here, you mentioned a little bit about there wasn't the security layer that you were hoping there would be.
Correct.
What else did you find? And tell us the implications for those of us who might not really understand that
The top. And I did start seeing my own kids coming home with accounts and some different web app services also from school. So there's a number of different things that can be problematic if the security is not in place. The one you think of first is just someone in between could be eavesdropping on that and getting access to the information. And a lot of these services are enabling kids to go perhaps to the neighborhood coffee shop and log in and do it, or their teachers perhaps to log in and use the site. And without getting too technical about it, there are ways, if it's not protected with the encryption, that a person can get access to the entire account, not just the part that the person is viewing at that time.
So those are issues of security specifically.
That's data security, right? One thing.
Okay. And how common is this across anyone's use of the web? Is this a specific issue to these particular technology companies, or is this something that we're all contending with and perhaps are not as aware of?
It is something we're all contending with.
Okay. So this is not something new, but yet I imagine the implication is that we're talking about our children here, and
right.
So the concern is even higher.
Yeah, right. It's a well-known vulnerability that got a lot of attention in 2011 with something called FireSheep that was letting people get into people's Facebook accounts at coffee shops. And as a result, a lot of those type companies did change to using the encryption.
So that leads to the question for me of if this is kind of a known vulnerability, right? Is that the good word for that?
Yes.
Why are technology companies creating these unsecure sites? Is that a good way to put it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Any thoughts? Krista?
Well, you know, I don't know that it's not about creating insecure sites. It's about that data has value and allows, you know, truly educational apps to use the information that they collect about how students are performing with them to improve their products and to allow them to assess students' performance on their learning. So it has value. It's just that, you know, it's who gets access to that data that's really is key. You know, it's about protecting kids from the marketing that might be used, but really not to prevent their performance and to prevent the ability for them to actually learn more effectively.
But isn't that more of an issue of privacy, right? How that data gets mined and how it potentially gets into the hands of marketers? I'm talking more about the security piece, about sort of layering something over the site so that the traffic between the users is secure. Why aren't technology companies kind of adopting that as a standard of practice as they're building their apps? Tony, go ahead.
Okay, yeah. So many industries do. Credit card industry, for example, has data security standards that the companies adhere to that are very specific. And right now, at least my observation of the ed tech in general is that the industry hasn't created such a standard. The governmental regulations use terms like commercially reasonable security, which is not clearly enough defined. And so there's kind of no consensus and no standard right now that, the community has agreed to. The community, I think, of educators, parents, and the industry need to work together to set.
Is it a question of money? Is it cost more to create
a little bit?
A little bit, yeah.
It's partly about money. I think it's also about market maturity. I think that's part of it. So you've got a lot of very small players in this market. You've got some very big players. You've got some companies that are not traditionally education companies and companies that are traditionally in education. And we see a wide array of security awareness among companies. We have lots of little tiny startups, and depending upon who those two or three people are in the startup, they may have great security awareness and they may have no security awareness. The bigger companies generally tend to do better. That's not across the board a statement, but as a rule, the bigger companies know what they're doing about security.
It just surprises me that this is sort of not a given to begin with. I'm sorry if I'm harping on this topic. Krista, you were going to say something there?
No, I was just sort of agreeing. It's sort of it really is a wild west out there. You know, technology moves at such a fast pace, and you know, we hate to presume that people are you know, doing anything with malintent. That it's just changes so quickly, and it is competitive. And yeah, there are different companies with different levels of resources to sort of throw at these things. So I would agree with Anne on that one, yeah.
And Todi, anything more about the security issues besides this lack of SSL layer across all platforms?
I've seen some other things, a little less technical, maybe things like some of these websites set up entire classes of kids and anyone can enter with a six-digit code with no second authentication by a teacher, for example. Or they're, you know, they allow very short passwords. Now, that's a little bit of a challenge because it's kids and they have to remember the passwords, but they allow a one-character password even. So there are just some practices like that. Or you can prove that they're not encrypting the passwords in their own storage.
I see. So that means it's easier to come.
That means
hack
if
in.
It's breached, no one will have to crack the password. They'll just have the password.
I see. Other issues, Anne, that you're thinking about or worrying about at Palo Alto?
There are a lot of issues around data privacy and security, but just on security, they're all keeping up with security is literally a full-time job. Everybody with a large organization has at least one full-time employee, sometimes hundreds of full-time employees working on security. Some of our vendors don't have that, and we find that if we get a vendor who's got very sensitive information and someone really wants to use them and we're not comfortable, we'll actually do our own testing on their site. We'll get their permission and do security and penetration testing to make sure their sites are secure and then give them the results of that and say, fix these things. And so these folks are essentially getting a very valuable security audit from us for free, just because we want to use their service and they're not quite ready for the prime time yet.
And just ballpark, what percentage of the apps or programs that you've tested actually meet your standards of security?
Well, my main security consultant has worked in the federal government in the past in very high security areas, so his standards are extraordinarily high. So I don't think anyone has ever satisfied him. But some people get pretty close. And, you know, we selectively test vendors. We're not going to go and say, Microsoft, we want to test your software. Mm-hmm. We trust that Microsoft is doing the best that they can do with their service. But some of these other vendors, these small ones, we do, and we give them some guidance on how to maintain their security practices.
That was one of the things that came out of our student privacy summit that we had in D.C. in February. Industry was a willing and partner to that summit, and they all said, you know, what we need here are some really industry best practices so we can all apply them so that we can move ahead on focusing on creating the best educational technology for students and, you know that these are the baseline standards. It would really move things forward.
And staying with you, Krista, Anne mentioned that it's a full-time job to vet technology and to monitor its integrity and its use within a school. That sounds expensive, a expensive undertaking. How equipped are school districts or schools across the country of varying size and endowment to be able to do this vetting on their own?
Well, this is the thing. You know, it takes a certain amount of resources and expertise. And frankly, parents and administrators have enough to do with educating our kids. So they also would like to know that, you know, these are how you apply these technologies. These are how you apply them and protect children. So, again, it's baseline standards. And it really takes everybody being involved in creating those baseline standards, sort of really to have educators know that when they select an app game or a website, they don't have to worry about, you know, really that back end stuff. They can just focus on applying it to the children and advance their learning. So, yeah, I mean, it was that Fordham study that came out in February that really, really got a lot of attention. Common Sense Media had started working on this issue back in the fall and recognizing that, you know, there was a real opportunity here to say, when it came to the consumer space, we really did let industry make the rules. When it comes to our children and our schools, let's just quickly get on top of this. And luckily, you know, there haven't been those horrible stories of the breaches like we've heard at Target, for instance, you know, online shopping and NSA security breaches. What we're recognizing is there is a momentum here to really develop some best practices so that teachers can focus on teaching. Districts don't have to spend huge amounts of money hiring contractors to help them figure it out. We have now the U.S. Department of Education saying, yeah, this is really the support that our educators need to succeed here.
And let's now switch over to the privacy piece here. So Tony, take us through this again. So we talked about security. Now tell us about the privacy concerns.
Sure, yeah. So I think my biggest concern with the privacy, well, a couple of things. I think there's a general concern that data is being collected. I think parents oftentimes don't even know who's collecting data about their kids and where when they go to school or, you know, as a part of school. And then, you know, as we've seen with other industries, it can be aggregated and then combined to start creating profiles of people. And this is done for adults. And I think, you know, I don't think we want to start doing that with our kids.
Because then that can in turn be used to market to the children?
Market or just characterize them. For example, what if you have a site that's tracking classroom behavior, a site that's used for reading progress, for example, another site that has their grades. Now you start putting all that data together, and you're starting to paint a picture of this kid and apply maybe a label to this kid when he's 5 years old. That's not going away, perhaps.
And where would that go? Map that out for us.
Sure. I mean, you know, a lot of these are small companies, so they're collecting their data. You know, let's say it's the behavioral app, but you know, how's a kid behaving in class app, and then the typing app or the reading app. They probably all have their own databases at some point. But you know, a lot of startups get acquired, right? And when they get acquired, the data comes with them. Mm. Right. So there, and the other thing I've noticed, a lot of privacy policies say we don't rent or sell your data, one, we reserve the right to change this at any time, and if so, we'll post it on this website on our privacy page, which I'm never going to see. Number one, and then the other thing is some of them come right and say, you know, it is a business asset, and we may choose to sell it as a business asset, or we may be acquired, or we may be liquidated, and it would go with it. Hmm. So it's kind of like they might change it and we'll never hear about it.
Right. So Krista, this brings up the business model here. What is, normally websites are looking for, traffic and using the traffic to get people to advertise on their website, and that generates revenue. How are these educational programs how are they revenue generating? Are they selling data? Is it what they charge the schools? I'm trying to figure out kind of what the motivation and the incentive is for these companies to heed some of Tony's concerns.
Well, there are laws that govern the space, so really it's about not breaking the law.
Just stay in line with legality here. Go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, there are some laws that govern the online space. FERPA, the Family Education Rights and Privacy Act, and COPPA as well. And there are opportunities to really give FERPA specifically. You know, it was enacted in 1974 before we had to even worry about this. Mm. It's time to update it and give it more teeth, because it really there are a lot of problems with it. You know, it doesn't cover directory information, that personal information that we care about, a child's name, address, telephone number, the contact details, date, place of birth, social security number, etc. And, there are still significant loopholes just because the law is so old. So companies, third-party companies, can't get access to that information. So we need some more strength behind those laws to protect children. We also, COPPA is really only applies to children under 13. So
tell us a little bit more about COPPA.
COPPA is the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act, and it's a very important law. It requires parental's consent before any kid under 13 can provide their personal identifiable information to a commercial service. So it's important. It offers protections, but only for children under 13 years of age. Taken together, they offer some protection, but not quite enough. So by strengthening those laws, giving schools some baseline standards, and really, staying on top of the issue, getting parents involved, we really have an opportunity to protect kids. As it gets to the business model, mm-hmm. I think what we really need to appreciate here is that while there are those services that are purchased, and obviously schools, when they're spending money, do the due diligence to make sure that what they're protecting is actually going to work for them and respect all of their rules and their children's privacy, there are those that are free. And what we really need to appreciate is that, they're not really free. You're paying for them with your data, with our children's data. So that's where we really need to have some savvy around this.
Data is currency.
It is.
Yeah. So what I'm getting here is that there are some laws out there that regulate how this information should be protected from being shared, but they're not completely up to date with the technology. And how aware actually are these startups about these laws? And you know, is this sort of an error of ignorance or something else?
Well, you know, I can't speak to all of them. I know even, you know, companies as big and as important and critical as Google, you know, have, you know, the recent situation where Google Apps for Education was getting a lot of attention, and then Google did do the right thing. It said, yes, you know, we acknowledge that perhaps we had been, yes, scanning accounts for advertising purposes, and we'll no longer do that. So due diligence on the part of parents and educators, really, it goes a long way to making sure that we are making moves to protect our children.
Right. So it sounds like, again, it's a shared responsibility. We shouldn't assume that the industry itself will self-police or self-regulate. I'm going to take a station break for a moment. This is City Visions on local public radio 91.7 KALW San Francisco and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're discussing the student data privacy issues with our guests Ann Duncan, Chief Information Officer with the Palo Alto Unified School District, Tony Porterfield, Engineer and Parent Advocate, and Krista Sumanic, Director of Communications for Common Sense Media. We open our phone lines now to invite you, our listeners, to call in with your comments and questions. 415-841-4134 is the number to dial. Again, that's 415-841-4134. You can email us at cityvisions@klw.org or post a comment directly on the KLW website. Do you have children in school who are using cloud-based programs to do their homework or manage grades and attendance? What questions do you have about all this information, how it's being stored and potentially shared? 415-841-4134 or cityvisions@kalw.org. So, Anne, I want to come back to you to talk about the at the school district level. You talked about setting up an infrastructure to vet this technology. What are some things that your school district is doing to bring parents into this conversation?
So we offer we require parents to update all their agreements every year for the district, and we share with them every year that they need to consent to their child to use the internet, and that some of the things that we do. But the bigger thing is the schools and the teachers talk to parents about what they use in their classrooms, particularly at the elementary level. I mean, as the kids get older, the parents are at school less, but there are open house nights and opportunities for parents to learn. But at the elementary level, the parents are very, very aware of what kids are using in the classroom. They're aware of what applications they have access to. And then at the middle school and high school, they get updates on parent nights. We also have two of our major applications where the parents have accounts. And so they have with our student information system and our learning management system. So the parents have their own accounts so they can log on and see information about their students, how the students are doing in class, and those sorts of things, while making sure they're only seeing their students' information and no other students' information.
Right. And Tony, what was, when you first stumbled upon this, how much transparency was there from the schools about their use of this kind of technology?
So in our district, they do a similar sort of general disclosure, I guess, or, you know, something the parents sign saying that they will be using technology in school. And I think they will name a few of the ones they're certain they're going to be using. But I think, as Ann mentioned earlier, a lot of times I think individual teachers are just deciding to use something. And I think as a parent, something I'd like to see is a more rigorous process there where there is an approved list of applications or services that teachers can use if they want to try a new one, just get it approved by the district first. Mm. So that number one, parents, if they say, what are all the apps my kids are using, someone can answer that question. Mm-hmm. And also, you know, they have a chance then to take a look themselves.
Mm. So Krista, quoted the Fordham Law School study in our intro, and it said that only 20% of districts inform parents that student information is being stored in the cloud. And obviously, the Palo Alto Unified School District is one of that 20%. But why is that number so low?
Why is it so low that parents are being informed? I'm sorry, Joseph.
Why is it that school districts are not informing parents more about their use of this technology in the classroom?
Well, I'd have to, you know, I'd have to just take a guess at that one, but I would think that, you know, there's a certain level of excitement and enthusiasm around adopting educational technology in the classroom, and, you know, the teachers, their job is to focus on teaching and making sure that children are learning. So, you know, thinking about sort of the privacy and security of any given app game or website is, it requires a certain level of expertise. We, you know, working with the teachers at our schools, you know, it's, there's a serious onboarding process for many. You know, you can be an amazing teacher but new to technology. You can be terrific with technology and new to teaching. It's finding that perfect balance within the two so that the technology is really a benefit and children, you know and it passes all levels of scrutiny for parents, teachers, and kids.
Anne, can you guess at why schools are not doing this more?
I can't tell you for sure other than the fact that districts are sort of overwhelmed, and it may also be an interpretation of that question, right? Mm. We may be, the district may be telling parents that they're using tools, but they may not be specifically saying, hey, this is where your data is. Mm. So I don't know the details of that, but, you know, districts are overwhelmed. A lot of staff are, in fact, using applications that IT or the district office aren't aware of.
So this is a really interesting question. Where I work, I can't download new programs onto my computer or applications. It just basically says, no, mm-hmm. you don't have the administrative privileges. Mm-hmm. What gives here? Why isn't that happening? And that sounds like a pretty easy fix.
So teachers are educators. They're very independent. And you know, they see themselves as having the same sort of academic freedoms that you might have as a college professor. So they very much believe that they should have control over everything that goes on in their classroom. And we work very hard to find a middle ground between I'm going to lock everything down and you can't change anything, and here's a wild, wild west. The other thing to keep in mind is here, and this may not be a great example in public radio, but in corporate America, I might have an IT technician for every 100 employees. I have an IT technician at the elementary level for every 1,700 students, and they come along with them a couple hundred employees. So I can't lock those computers down, and I'm better staffed than many, many school districts. So the challenge between the teacher independence, that inability to provide that deep support, and also the fact that you've got vendors constantly coming in with offers, here's a product, whether they're finding it online or in our area, those startups are coming directly in.
Tony?
Yeah, I just wanted to add, I think tying into both what Anne and Krista said, this idea of, I think, we can't expect every teacher to be a technical expert on all this stuff and all the privacy policies and the arcane details of the technology, which is why there's, I think it's really important to have best practices, as Krista was mentioning, that were discussed at the Privacy Summit in D.C., best practices and maybe even some form of rating system or seal of approval that says these sites meet this certain standard or criteria, so that the people making these decisions, which would be the parents and the teachers, you know, have the information they need, because right now I don't think they do. The companies will say they're secure. Mm-hmm. And then there's not really right now an independent arbiter to say whether or not that's true. And as I said, I don't think it's fair to expect every teacher to understand all of that. It's not.
But it also sounds like it's not feasible to manage it to the point, and maybe you don't want to restrict teachers' freedom to the point where they aren't able to pick and choose amongst these programs.
Part of it is we need to teach the teachers how to recognize what programs they need to ask us about. Some of them, many, many things they use in their classroom, we don't care if they're using them, in the sense that there's no student data. So it's not an important thing. There's also some where I can put a student's first name in and they can go. And if I've got a fifth grader named Johnny, there might be 30 fifth graders named Johnny. That's not personally identifiable. So it depends how much data they're gathering. And so we need to teach those teachers to identify the things that are concerning so that we can work with them on that. And that's what we focus on, is identifying the things we need to look at with them, because we can't vet thousands of programs.
Right. 415-841-4134 is the number to dial to join our conversation tonight on City Visions here on 91.7 KALW San Francisco, as we talk about student data privacy in our schools. schools with our guests and Duncan of the Palo Alto Unified School District, Tony Porterfield, engineer and parent advocate, and Krista Sumanic, director of communications at Common Sense Media. 415-841-4134. You can also email us at cityvisions@kalw.org or post a comment directly at the KALW website. So, Tony, when you got the notification from your school, how easy was it to understand, and how equipped is the average parent to understand exactly what they're either consenting to or choosing not to opt out of? Let's put it this way.
I think it's fairly general. The statement you get from the school, so it doesn't certainly list every application that the students are going to use, or necessarily even sort of the more administrative things like the related to registration, things like that. So I think it is difficult. If you're really concerned about knowing every place your child's data is going, it's difficult to do. Hmm. Difficult for a school district to provide that because there are a lot of different systems.
And Krista, what are you advocating for in terms of the level of disclosure, shall we say, that a school district should share with its parents?
Well, I mean, basically, letting parents understand what technology is being used in their schools. It's a constant conversation, and empowering parents to be able to ask questions about, you know, what information is being collected about their children and how it's used, and how is the data that is collected stored, and who has access to it, and when does it expire? So, you know, that's the parent's role. We really, again, want to make sure that we create an environment in where technology can be seen as an asset in a classroom, and that really requires then, you know, creating these principles around how to use it. And that's really where Common Sense Media has focused most of their effort on creating these three basic principles. Really, if I could just tell you what they are.
Sure.
That students, the information should only be used for educational purposes. Let's all agree to that. That their online activity should not be used to target advertising at them. And that schools and education technology providers, the industry, should really adopt appropriate security retention and destruction policies, because we just want to make sure that, you know, when as soon as kids enter kindergarten, they're tracked, and by the time for the next 20 years, that those records follow them. So if we can just create some industry best practices, strengthen the laws at the state and federal level around technology used in schools, and inform parents, then we're really creating an environment in which technology can be a major asset to personalized learning for all our kids.
So it sounds like it's a little bit of everyone's responsibility, all the adults in the room.
It truly
right?
is. Truly is.
And in fact, getting parents on board, getting school districts to inform their teachers about what standards to look out for, and really bringing the tech industry along to adhere to the best practices that you discuss.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, speaking of the tech industry, I mentioned at the beginning of the program that we were not able to book one of the tech industry ed tech companies that we reached out to several, but we do have a statement that I wanted our guests here to respond to, and this is from Aiden Fine, the Chief Privacy Officer of Edmodo. Aiden states, "The safety and security of our users has always been critical to Edmodo, and today there are over 34 million educators, students, and parents using Edmodo as their preferred learning platform. One key reason is our commitment to user privacy. This commitment to privacy is why we have privacy protections and parental involvement and oversight built directly into our product. It's also why we don't rent or sell student information to third parties, and why we don't share any information with third parties for marketing or advertising purposes. Our goal is, and always has been, to empower teachers with valuable tools that help students reach their full potential and to protect their privacy at the same time." So, Tony, that sounds pretty good. Is it actually as good as it sounds?
Well, I think the first thing I'll say is give them credit for, about a year ago they did switch to full SSL across the board, full encryption of their site. And I think among many that I've looked at, they actually are near the top in terms of security.
Hmm. And how about the privacy piece?
A couple things that I'm a couple questions I have there. They have a lot. One thing, and this is not unique to them, but there are these third party apps that you can install into them, into Edmodo, and what they do is they push a whole classroom's information out to that third party app that the teacher's installed into her classroom. So you got a whole classroom worth of kids. I've seen pictures and names at LISCO, and I think there's not a uniform enforcement based on what I've seen. And again, not just to single out the one company. I think that's true of many.
Yes.
That exists with Edmodo, with Schoology, with Google, with a lot of the vendors that they build this marketplace, which is really very valuable to teachers because they can have this seamless experience. But all of those products in that marketplace, whether they're free or whether there's a charge, are governed by their own policies, which are varying quality. So what we have is we have app installation turned off on those, and the teachers have to come ask us before they can install something. And we had a recent experience with one vendor where people really wanted this app, and we looked at the terms, and our attorneys were horrified. We just said, and they said, well, actually, other attorneys are kind of horrified by this vendor's terms, too. We're all talking about it, and the vendor said, oh, we're rewriting those, which didn't surprise us a great deal based on the response. But our staff was very upset that they couldn't use it right away, and we said, we'll work with this vendor, but you have to wait. And teachers don't want to wait. They want to use that. And so if there were some standard contractual agreements that vendors could take into this space, that would be hugely helpful.
Not naming any names here, but what are some of those horrific terms that you describe?
So they were pushing all responsibility for compliance with the law, so FERPA, COPPA, and any other ed code, all those things. They were pushing those back to us.
To the school district.
To the school district. They were binding, they were requiring the and while this sounds like a good practice on the surface, it's a nightmare. They were saying, you have to get our agreement form signed by every single family. And that was in a click wrap agreement.
What's a click wrap agreement?
So basically it's a click through where you click on it and you're done. So like you do when you sign up for a new site.
When
sure,
I rush through, and accept the terms that I don't really know anything about. Yeah.
And we had, they offer a standalone product. So as a teacher, you could click through on that standalone product and then bind yourself as personally liable because it says, as a teacher, you can bind the district. Well, our teachers don't have the right to bind the district, so therefore they'd be binding themselves as personally liable. There were no guarantees against sharing data. So there were a lot of issues that we were very concerned about, and they've said, we'll work with you, but people have to wait to use it, and they're really quite interested in using that product. So.
God, what a long way we've come from the Scholastic Reader. Or those LPs that were like, tuned to the slide set. Anyway, it's pretty amazing. And I'm not that old. 415-841-4134 to join us tonight on City Visions here at KLW San Francisco and on the web at klw.org as we talk about student privacy. As school districts are trying to embrace the plethora of educational technologies that are coming at them to help better educate our students and prepare them for the lives that they will lead ahead. 415-841-4134 if you want to join our conversation with our guests. Any concerns that you have as a parent about this technology, and how aware are you that this technology is being used in your child's school? Or if you're a startup type and are thinking about this problem, what kind of solutions do you see to the questions raised tonight? 415-841-4134 or email us at cityvisions@klw.org. We have a email here from James in Palo Alto. And the question is it common in terms of service of these ed tech companies that the company can sell personally identifiable information to a third party? So again, is this something that unless you're vetting and looking out for that, that's kind of a given that in most cases this data will be sold to a third party?
I think most vendors in ed tech don't try that one. I think they know they can't. But we do certainly say, 20 or 30% of the agreements we see allow them pretty broad ability to share data. They pretty much all have a fairly standard term that we change about their ability to share at their discretion in the case of a legal requirement. And we really ratchet that down.
And Krista?
You know, it's I would like to sort of say that I would hate to think that people are taking advantage of the data that they can access, the personal identifiable information that they can get from schools. I mean, it's hard to say. The only thing that I can point to is the furor that came around Google Apps for Education, and they did the right thing. It was a first step. There's a long way to go, but you know, it became very clear that when students were using their Google applications, they would get ads targeted to them. Just like when I go on my Google accounts, I get ads for wrinkle creams, and my 15-year-old daughter gets it for weight loss. You know, it's sort of it's the way of the world. And so I don't, you know, I can't really answer that to say what they're really doing, but we got to make sure that they can't.
Yeah, Anne.
I just want to clarify that with Google Apps for Education, prior to them turning off the traffic monitoring or creating a separate stream for the education, you could turn off ads in education. And I doubt there's a single school district or even higher education group that had ads on. So students using Google Apps would not see ads. But that processing was going on in the background. And I agree, it's great that Google built themselves a bypass so that they don't have to even worry about that anymore.
Staying with the parent issue for just a moment, or the parent role in this, I did mention also in the introduction about the folding of In Bloom based on parental outrage. Is this a sign, Tony, of parents of plugging in, so to speak, to this a little bit more and voicing some really important concerns? Is it a little bit of reaction to sort of suddenly finding out that their children's data is potentially compromisable?
Yeah, well, I think what put a lot of parents' antennas up about In Bloom was the types of information that some school districts were planning to upload to that. Not just sort of name and maybe picture or name and address, but even disabilities or, you know, educational plans and things like that. And I think definitely, it was probably the biggest example of parents standing up and opposing something this way, you know, related to the data in the cloud. I think actually it was a pretty good technical solution based on what I knew about it. But I think they didn't tell their story well.
Yeah, conceptually, In Bloom is a wonderful idea, the ability to aggregate data about students in order to enable you to educate them better, to personalize instruction, and to follow a student throughout their career to understand their needs. And, you know, there are countries that do that. The UK has a pretty good program that they can track students over their career and also predict outcomes pretty consistently because they have so much data about so many kids. But that's really scary data to put together, and so you have to have to be very careful about how you handle it. And the In Bloom got some very, very bad press and some big concerns, and it's a shame to see the idea fold, whether In Bloom was the right time or company.
Right, and I think there's this idea that, you know, do it in one place and do it right versus there's some sort of a patchwork approach right now, just because you've got a lot of small companies doing it, and they're all over the place on the security practices. So the promise of having one central place and really getting the security nailed down, I think, did have some appeal. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Chris, did you want to add something there?
Yeah, you know, sort of earlier in this year, we did a survey of parents. We wondered just how savvy are parents about this. The In Bloom conversation was getting hotter, and really what we asked parents was, are you concerned with how companies with non-educational interests are able to access and use students' information? Well, you know, 90% of respondents said they are very concerned, 64% very, very concerned, 90% concerned. But then we turned around and asked, well, do you know about how your schools are currently collecting, using, and storing and destroying your students' data? And only 13% knew much about it. So somewhere in between those two, the not really understanding what's being collected, how it's being collected, you know, what it's being used for, and yet having high concern about it. It was an environment in which, you know, it's going to have some challenges.
Right. So let's talk some more about the three pillars of your solution there, Krista, and one of them being about addressing legislation. So tell us a little bit more about what has come out of the conversations that you've been in with the Department of Education and other educators around how COPPA and FERPA should be strengthened. And then actually, if you could also talk about some local state laws that are being proposed here in California.
Sure. Well, I mean, just this week, May 1st, the White House, you know, released their big data and privacy report. And one of the key recommendations there was to really was calling for executive action to protect student data privacy. So we expect that we will see something at the federal level to give more protection around the collection of student data, the collection, use, and storage, and destruction of it. At the state level, you know, there's over 80 different bills in states across this country to cover the use of student data in the states. In California specifically, Senator Daryl Steinberg has introduced legislation called the Student Online Personal Information Protection Act, or called SOPIPA. And this bill would, I mean, really put California at the forefront, just as it's really been a leader in privacy protections for the country. This is yet another step toward that. It would really do exactly as we would hope, and that is make sure that the data that's collected is for educational purposes only. And it would require operators to keep student information safe by adequately encrypting it. It would require that students' information is destroyed when it's no longer needed for school purposes. It can't live in perpetuity. So we are watching that with great enthusiasm. Common Sense Media was a strong advocate to see this legislation introduced.
And how long are we talking here in terms of all of this updating or approval of new legislation?
Well, it's going through the process. It's gone through the Education Committee and the Judicial Committee, so it's moving along. I can't put a timeline on it specifically, but it's moving in the right direction, most definitely. And at the federal level as well, in addition to strengthening FERPA, we have Senator Edward Markey, who has talked about also introducing legislation to protect student data specifically. So there is definitely momentum toward this, and it's the Secretary of Education, Arne Duncan, has said it really does require state-level legislation as well.
But that raises the question of what if different states adopt different standards?
It does get tricky. That's why we talk about let's agree to a baseline that we can all sort of say this is the floor, and you can layer up on that depending what the needs are within your own state. But let's all agree to the minimum.
Hmm. And so staying again with you for a little bit more about some of the other best practices, you've outlined a few, but again, let's hit the top three. Let's say that we were really hoping that we can see enacted in the near term.
Do you mean specifically what Common Sense Media is hoping to see with
Yes.
our student data privacy? Well, it's exactly that students' information is for educational purposes only, that their personal information and their online activity is never used for commercial purposes, and that schools and ed tech providers, the industry piece, are following appropriate security retention and destruction policies and making it easy for teachers to apply technology without the concern that the student's data is at risk. Like, that's, again, I get back to those click wraps.
Right, right.
That's just bananas. Whoever reads those.
Right. Basically, I think of checklists here, right? Checklists for parents of questions they should be asking their schools and school districts, and checklists for teachers to be asking, and some sort of seal of approval maybe that comes with this ahead of time. Tony?
Yeah, I just wanted to add, and getting back to what we were talking about, like, parents wanted to know every site maybe that their kids' information on. If there are standards and processes in place, then the parents don't really need to list as much or maybe at all anymore, right? As long as there's sort of a baseline, as Krista was talking about. You know, if the school's using it, it meets this standard, which means it's doing these things, then, you know, I think parents can relax a little bit about not needing to know about every single service that's being used.
I wanted to get one of our callers on the line. We have Gray from San Francisco, and I understand that you're a teacher. Is that right, Gray?
Hi, yeah, that's right.
Welcome
I
to the program.
I teach 6th and 7th grade in the public schools here.
Wonderful. What's your question or comment?
Well, I use technology rather extensively in my classroom. I have outfitted all my students each have computers, and they're old laptops, but they work. And I'm always trying to, you know, walk that careful line over what kind of information might be dispelled. And it is kind of sometimes daunting, not to know if even what seems like relatively innocent information, like just the child's first name, somehow is being connected with other things that are going on at the school. But at the same time, a lot of, especially in the public school, a lot of these applications are expensive to use. You know, Google Ads for Education is free, so that's, you know, great. I've been using it for a couple of years. But I don't know, is it okay if I say some of the ones that I've been using, or I'm not sure if we're...
Sure, go ahead.
So I use a product called iXL rather extensively, and I also use the school uses something called Study Island, and we also use something called Manga High in my classroom, and they all are math, basically math applications, because that's what I teach. Mm. But none of them require anything more than, at the most, a child's first and sometimes last name. And what I've done is created pseudonyms for the kids in the registration process so that that isn't tracked. But I do sometimes wonder if that's enough. Mm. My last thing I just wanted to observe is that some of them are pretty expensive. You know, we're talking about $8 to $12 a seat for a school to enroll in some of these applications. And the ones that are free, of course, are the ones that are going to have targeted advertising on them. So I guess that's a rather broad observation. But in the end, I think that it does require some care, but it does have a lot of value inherent in having that technology available.
Right. It sounds on the bell-shaped curve. You're far to the right here in terms of your savvy. How did you learn all this?
Before I was a teacher, I was in tech for a while.
Ah, there we go. So maybe you should start a blog for your fellow teachers on what to be looking out for. Thanks so much for your call.
Sure.
And we also have an email from Alec, and Alec says, I am an IT provider for an educational institution, as well as the parent of two young children. Are there any available resources, public or private, for obtaining information about or vetting any of these educational sites or apps? So some of this checklist stuff that we're talking about. Anne?
So COSIN, which is a consortium for school networking, published a report recently that I think is pretty good. It's called the Protecting Privacy and Connected Learning Toolkit, which anyone can download from their site, and it walks you through the steps for an institution to vet a program. I think that's a pretty good one in terms of what's available out there, and our other guests may have some ideas.
How about you, Krista?
You know, we have through graphite.org, which is a resource for teachers to go and find really high quality educational technology for their classrooms. We rate for really learning potential, but there is a conversation there among our teacher community. We have access to expert teachers in all states, you know, over 150,000 teachers who are registered to use our products, and they say, you know, they provide their best practices and the experience that they've had with these apps, and we do have conversations about privacy within there. So please, that's a great place for teachers to go and check out graphite.org.
Great, and we'll go ahead and link those two websites to our website, which is cityvisions at klw.org. So the music means we got to end. And so that's City Visions for this evening. Our guests tonight were Anne Duncan, Tony Porterfield, and Krista Sumanik. Thanks so much for joining me this evening.
Thank you.
For a link to this and other City Vision shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page at klw.org. Our engineer this evening was Kevin Vance. Tonight's show was produced by Victoria Thorpe. Join me next week as we explore the rise of solar power in the Bay Area. For my co-host David Onick and the entire team at City Visions, this is Joseph Pace. Thanks for listening. Good night and have a great week.